Korean company Samsung seems to have a problem at the top.
Every single Lee family member who has been a chairman of Samsung, so this is three generations, has been convicted of some kind of crime.
But Samsung is crucial to the South Korean economy, so after his crimes, the latest Lee gets a presidential pardon. Also today, the high-tech war fought in the skies above Ukraine. Drones are having a big impact.
All sides have learned very quickly how to attach munitions and grenades to these drones and drop them with great accuracy right on top of their targets.
Plus, the hidden worlds of geocachers.
The neat thing for me that I've seen in all the people that I've met in the game from all over the world, it's ignited this spirit in them for adventure that maybe they didn't know how to find before.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it with us to Friday. The Mexican government has made a stunning admission. It's now saying that the disappearance of 43 students back in 2014 was a state crime. A government-sponsored truth commission implicated all levels of government and concluded that the Mexican army was responsible for at least not stopping the abductions. Kate Doyle is following all of this. She's a senior analyst of U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive. Kate, remind us about the basics of this case back in 2014, the 43 abducted students known as the Ayotzinapa 43. It really shook the nation. I mean, you can still see the number 43 painted on houses across Mexico, a reminder of the cold case quality of the story. What happened?
It was a traumatic episode, Marco, when 43 plus, there were about 100 actually students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teacher Training School in Guerrero, which is in the southwest of Mexico, were passing through a town called Iguala in five buses that they were taking back to their school when the buses were stopped by local police. They were fired on by the police. And ultimately, the students were taken out of the buses and 43 of them taken away in the backs of pickup trucks by the cops. They were never seen again. And it evolved as an investigation began to be launched that a criminal gang that also operated in Iguala had taken these same 43 young men from the police in agreement with them and disappeared them.
What are the key findings of the new report from the Truth Commission?
Well, I think that the report is important because, first of all, it offers a kind of transparency about this dark case that Mexicans have never seen or heard before. And so this report is one way for this government, this new investigation, to tell the Mexican people exactly what they have been finding. And they were pretty clear that, first of all, after looking through tens of thousands of documents from 15 different federal agencies, after conducting dozens of searches all over the state of Guerrero, after issuing more than 100 arrest warrants, that they believe that the kidnapping of the students was a collusion between the criminal gang in Iguala and not just the local police, but all different levels of local, state, and federal officials in Mexico to carry out this crime and then subsequently cover it up. So that right there was a pretty shocking revelation.
Do we know the answer to this basic question? Why did this gang kill these young men in collusion with police at all these levels of government?
We really don't. And I think it's important to say that the Truth Commission report that was released yesterday was not the end of the work, neither of the commission or of the special prosecutor's office within the Attorney General's office that is pursuing this case with its new investigation. So they were able to tell Mexicans that Mexican government officials, police, and Guerreros Unidos, this gang, had acted in a corrupt manner to kidnap boys that they may have confused with rival drug traffickers in the region. But they are not yet ready, willing, or perhaps able, we don't know yet, to tell us precisely why these boys were taken in the way that they were.
Do we know how the families of the abducted students, dead students, are reacting to this news?
The families who have been fighting, mobilizing, speaking out, and marching every single month of every single year for 8 years since their boys disappeared, I think I can safely say feel a sense of disappointment and letdown. Because why? The big news of the Truth Commission and of the press conference yesterday was that it was the state. So by saying this terrible incident, this terrible human rights crime, was a crime of the state, is nothing new for the parents. They've known that all along. It is a relief to hear the Mexican government officially claim that this was an act of state violence and corruption.
Kate, what implications do these new revelations have from the Truth Commission's report on the dead Ayotzinapa 43 in 2014, especially this week as gang violence has just run amok in Mexico with charges that the state is allowing it to happen?
If the report and the ongoing investigation ultimately lead to the convictions of not only people who carried this crime out and disappeared their boys, but also the Mexican officials, starting with the Attorney General, according to the report, who covered up the truth in this case in order to blur and hide or erase what truly happened. If those people are brought to justice, and if the students, more students, are found, the remains of students, I think that this whole process will have ultimately borne the fruit that it promised. You know, listening to Secretary Encinas, Alejandro Encinas, present this report, it certainly was powerful to hear him willing to voice accountability, to explain the cover-up, to indict verbally members of, you know, military, police, and all kinds of layers of the government. But I think the significance of this report is only in what comes next.
How has the government of President Manuel López Obrador handled this case since he took office? And what is he saying now?
López Obrador promised from the time of his presidential campaign that he would put every resource imaginable into solving the case. To his government's credit, that has happened. For many Mexicans who know that the numbers of people who are disappeared or missing in the country, they stand now at something like 105,000 documented cases. And so I think that as long as the Ayotzinapa case remains open and unsolved, most Mexicans feel that the hope for real justice and accountability on all the other tens of thousands of cases have disappeared is very, very remote indeed.
Kate Doyle is a senior analyst on U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive. She's also co-producer of a PRX podcast with Reveal called After Ayotzinapa. She joined us from New York. Kate, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
This weekend, hundreds of people will find their way to Seattle for the 20th anniversary celebration of geocaching. It's technically the 22nd anniversary, but, you know, pandemic. Geocaching is the worldwide treasure hunt, or, okay, trinket hunt, made possible by the wide use of GPS. Reporter Melissa Rodman has a story of some hardcore geocachers who have circled the globe searching for these hidden stashes of stuff.
It all started in 2000. President Bill Clinton had just made the Global Positioning System, or GPS, accessible to the public. A GPS enthusiast hid a container filled with bric-a-brac in the Oregon woods, posted its coordinates online, and encouraged people to find it with handheld GPS devices.
There's a joke that I will probably butcher it, but says something like, oh, geocaching is using multi-billion dollar technology to find household plastic hidden in the woods. So I think we're going to need to go around.
Or over.
Or over. The idea is, we try to break the law as little as possible.
Chip Tutu has been geocaching for a decade or so.
And what it will have inside, that's the most important, is a log. You need to take a pen and sign your name. And then everything else is supposed to be random things that you can trade. Take something, leave something. I think you're good.
Oh, yeah, I see something.
Ta-da!
The game's taken him around the world in pursuit of these hidden containers, or caches.
I was able to go to a geocache that took me to the edge of Reykjavik, where there was this lighthouse that you could access only during certain times because of the tides. It's not in travel guides, so it could take you to places you would not discover.
Currently, there are more than 3 million caches out there, but players no longer use early 2000s handheld GPS devices to find them. Instead, You just download the geocaching app, which looks a lot like Google Maps. A pin pops up on each geocache you're seeking, and a little blue dot mirrors your movements as you approach it.
So we're getting close to the cache now. We're just a few meters away.
Simon Evans has been geocaching in 84 countries and counting. He recently recorded himself on an expedition with some fellow cachers in a forest on the outskirts of a town called Hellendoorn in the Netherlands.
And we can actually spot this one on approach. And it is a little bird box attached to the tree with a little container and logbook for us to sign and record our adventure on the geocaching.com website.
Sometimes, though, Evan says the cache itself is less conspicuous.
There's so many different types of hides. It could be a nano container. A nano is about the size of the nail on your small finger, which contains a logbook. It could be a fake snail attached to a post. It could be a fake nut and bolt. It can be fake chewing gum. Other people, they climb trees. That's not my sort of thing. Others go diving in the sea and find boxes in the sea. It can be anything.
You're going to lift all sorts of rocks. You're going to put your hands behind things. So you need to be careful. If somebody that doesn't know what's happening will see you finding it, they'll get curious. They may take it and not understand what it is and just take it. Or they'll think it's a security risk and call the police or, you know.
Specific regional guidelines have been established to make sure players place their caches in acceptable locations. Railroads, playgrounds, and schools don't allow caches on site. Once a cache's location is approved and published online, players can view its page in the app. Annie Love started caching in 2004.
Some people will, you know, call their cache tweet tweet. And okay, that tells me as an experienced cacher that I'm probably looking for a fake birdhouse and the cache is inside the fake birdhouse. And sometimes there's an even greater hints of like, really, it's a fake rock in a pile of rocks.
Love is the senior business development manager at Geocaching HQ in Seattle, hosting this weekend's anniversary festivities.
I've gone all over the world and had instant friends. The neat thing for me that I've seen in all the people that I've met in the game, it's ignited this spirit in them for adventure that maybe they didn't know how to find before.
Geocaching also can help people see their own neighborhoods through a new lens. Chip Tutu reflected on one such encounter he had in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, for example, I took a local guy to a spot he's never been to, and he's lived like in that area like 20 years.
The cache they sought was stashed in the ruins of an arena where fights between elephants and tigers once were staged. But how would they find this bygone place?
And it's like, oh, let me see if I know how to get there. I'm like, don't worry about it. I can guide you there. I have a GPS in the map. I'll tell you where to turn.
A hidden world, around the world, for the world. I'm Melissa Rodman.
Coming up on The World, the U.S. has finally passed a key piece of legislation to help the climate. Also playing catch-up, Australia. Just ahead, we'll look at what Australia's planning and whether it goes far enough. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After years of being a global disappointment on climate action, the U.S. has at long last passed some major legislation. The Inflation Reduction Act dedicates hundreds of billions of dollars to supporting clean energy alternatives. The act is catching the attention of another country that's also lagged behind historically, Australia. A new left-wing government there has made bold statements about its plans to lower emissions. To discuss this, I'm joined by Australia climate policy expert and author Ketan Joshi. The left-wing Labour government of newly arrived Anthony Albanese has pushed forward a new bill that sets new emissions targets for Australia. How meaningful is that legislation, Ketan?
The bill that has just been submitted to the lower house and will all, in all likelihood pass through the Senate later on this year is a bit more symbolic than it is a meaningful lever for emissions reductions. What it does is it takes Australia's target, which is a 43% reduction on 2005 levels by the year 2030, and it formalizes it in a sense. And what that means is that there are a few agencies that can kind of point to it and say, look, we're using this as part of our decision-making process. But beyond that, it's certainly not a major spending bill like the US is.
So what do you think Australia could learn or gain from the climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act?
One similarity that really comes to mind is how there's really a focus on incentives. There's a lot of effort to try and get things in place that sort of very gently encourage businesses to reduce emissions. But I think one key difference to me is how much cash there is in terms of like the sheer quantity of cash going towards incentivizing renewable energy and electric vehicles and a bunch of other areas for emissions reductions. And also the focus on justice, like environmental justice and climate justice. These are all things that are lacking from Australia's mix of climate policies at the moment. Hopefully, there's going to be a push for some of these things, because I don't think Australia is going to reach its emissions targets without a strong set of cash incentives to get these technologies in place.
I mean, there's another thing that the U.S. and Australia have in common, and that's very polarized governments that have a strong desire on one side for climate action and a strong push to maintain the fossil fuel status quo on the other, like coal. How can either country plan for the long term, knowing that the next leaders could simply undo their work?
I think one really basic principle that I would love to see from both governments a bit more is a bit of a reckoning, a bit more honesty in terms of the kind of really, really looming challenges that they have to deal with. And the one thing that immediately comes to mind is fossil fuel extraction. Of course, Australia extracts and sells a lot more fossil fuels comparatively relative to population than the US. These are things that affect domestic emissions quite a lot. If there's a sort of hesitation to deal with them, then it puts a lot of communities and people at risk, because if there's a sudden reduction in demand for the products that they're digging up and selling, then it's going to have really, really bad outcomes. And I think potentially people could come to sort of loathe climate action and climate policies. These are the sort of areas that aren't really well covered in these climate policies and these climate bills. And I think that they really need to have a much more longer term approach to this problem.
How much do you think the climate change debate has shifted in Australia and is continuing to shift?
Yeah, it's really noticeable. You know, people have concerns about things like cost of living, democracy, and trust in government, things like that. I think kind of what's happened is that people are starting to realize that climate change is no longer a line item on that list. It's actually something that is bubbling in the background of each and every one of them, particularly cost of living and energy bills. So it's really focused everybody's mind on taking immediate actions that not only prevent disasters, but also ease some of those pressures that people are experiencing day to day.
Ketan Joshi is a climate policy expert on Australia and an author. He's been speaking with us from Oslo, Norway. Ketan, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Singapore is home to Asia's busiest and most modern airport. Not far from Changi Airport's duty-free shops and business class lounges, there's a prison that carries out Singapore's executions. Several reports say the government so far this year has put to death 10 inmates. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, some Singaporeans see hypocrisy between the country's polished image and these recent executions.
They always hang inmates at dawn. The condemned only have a short walk from their cell to the execution chamber, where the noose goes around their neck and a trap door opens under their feet. Others on death row think they can hear it through the walls.
Those whose cells are closer say they can sometimes hear a loud sound, and then they know that it's probably the trap door.
Kirsten Han is one of Singapore's most outspoken death penalty abolitionists. She writes a newsletter called We the Citizens.
And then they'll tell the families to go to the prison around 9 in the morning to identify and claim the body.
Singapore is not the world's top executioner. That would be China, followed by Iran. But in years past, this country of 5.5 million people has had the most executions per capita. Han says this year the pace is heavy.
There has been an ongoing situation of death sentences outpacing executions.
Singapore is mostly hanging people for the same crime, drug trafficking. And it doesn't take much to get the death penalty. One man is on death row for 2 pounds of cannabis. Another, hanged this year, had 1.5 ounces of heroin and a severe mental disability, according to his lawyers. Kirsten Han says these executions are not helping to stop the narcotics trade.
We are not seeing drug barons on death row. We are seeing a lot of low-level guys.
But that is part of the strategy. Officials don't deny their policies are rigid. Singaporeans grow up watching government ads depict even casual drug use as sinister.
Ecstasy. Ever wondered what it does to your brain?
The ad shows a human brain in a blender. Government messaging says our tough policies make Singapore one of the world's safest places. According to a government study released this year, 66% of Singaporeans support the execution of drug traffickers. But Han says that's to be expected.
It's not surprising that after a lifetime of being told that the death penalty works, that when you then survey people, people say, yes, I support it because the death penalty works.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has said it deplores this wave of executions. But Singaporean officials say they won't bend to outside pressure. The Minister for Home Affairs, K. Shanmugam, said this in a parliamentary speech earlier this year.
It's a fair assumption to say that more people will traffic drugs into Singapore, more drugs will enter into Singapore, there will be more drug abusers in Singapore, and more Singaporean families and individuals will be harmed if we remove the death penalty, in particular the mandatory death penalty.
But officials are facing pushback from their own citizens, too. Protests in Singapore are rare and heavily surveilled by the state. Yet vigils for death row inmates have drawn crowds this year, one bringing out 400 people. Kirsten Han says, for Singapore, that is a big protest.
You've seen more young Singaporeans do things like personally bring letters to the president's office seeking clemency for death row prisoners.
Though speaking out can come with a price.
For instance, I'm currently being investigated for 2 counts of illegal assembly.
Illegal assembly, in this case, means lighting candles with friends outside the main prison, near the airport. And on another night, Han took a photo with friends wearing anti-death penalty t-shirts. Activists do expect more hangings in months to come. So far this year, Singapore has executed 2 more prisoners than the United States, a country with a population nearly 60 times larger. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
You're with The World. Canada has 2 official languages, English and French, but the country's linguistic landscape is changing. More and more there, Punjabi and Hindi are spoken.
Language is really at the core of the evolution of Canada as a country.
Also ahead, in Spain, August means festival season. Some there wonder, is it too much of a good thing? Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The heir to South Korea's biggest company, Samsung, is free after serving 18 months in jail. Lee Jae-yong, known widely in the West as J.Y. Lee, was convicted of attempting to bribe former President Park Geun-hye of South Korea. Lee was trying to grease the wheels to secure his succession as head of the company. South Korea's current president, Yoon Suk-yeol, granted Lee a special pardon. The country's justice ministry said Lee was needed to help overcome a national economic crisis. Jeffrey Kane is the author of Samsung Rising, which is all about the company's enormous success and the family behind it. Jeff, we know the original crime J.Y. Lee was indicted for involved millions of dollars in bribes, even equestrian lessons to the daughter of the former president's confidant. There was a lot of outrage over the scandal. It brought down Park's government. Lee was sentenced to 30 months in prison. How did we get to this presidential pardon?
Well, it's actually a familiar pattern. It might sound strange or odd, but in South Korea, this is the fundamental pattern that exists with big businesses. There are many of these leaders of conglomerates called chaebol, which means a family-run conglomerate, who commit crimes, who are found guilty of various white-collar crimes such as tax evasion or bribery and so forth. But in the end, they will be given a full presidential pardon to return to their businesses and to not just turn out a profit, but to serve the nation. This is the crisis that South Korea is now facing. There is major global instability in the semiconductor industry. And so now the president has decided that to solve this problem, Samsung needs its family leader back at the helm.
I mean, the idea of serving the nation, how bad is the South Korean national economic crisis and what will Lee actually do to mitigate it? Because as the justice ministry implies, he sounds like he'll be a savior. Is that a lot of work for one person?
It is a lot of work for one person. But in South Korean corporate culture, the family leader is seen as a kind of god or a king overseeing the realm. People will often study their texts, study their books, learn, memorize their quotations and parts of their speeches. Even at Samsung, at one point, this doesn't happen anymore, but Samsung used to hold a mass game ceremony. So I don't know if you've seen in North Korea and other communist countries, they hold these big marches.
Right, they hold up those cars, kind of like little pixels, yeah.
Exactly. So Samsung used to do the exact same thing and make images of Samsung TVs and you know, phones and the logo and so forth, and they would sing songs for the company. It is a very intense military-like culture that demands absolute loyalty to the founding family, in this case, the founding Lee family. One of the strengths of this Samsung family model is that once the family leader makes a decision and announces his vision, the executives fall into line and execute it. They don't ask questions. They don't fight back. They don't resist. The bureaucracy, the top-down bureaucracy, is extremely efficient in Samsung. And if they want to execute, they will execute. They will make it happen.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, scandals and crimes, it's almost a habit for the Lee family. So what's happened before?
Every single Lee family member who has been a chairman of Samsung, so this is three generations, has been convicted of some kind of crime.
Wow. That public haranguing when Samsung gets caught up in these scandals would seem to be theatrical, because polling shows that 3/4 of the public in South Korea support the pardon of Lee. What's up with that?
The public, by and large, supports it. There has been protests. You know, there has been controversy. There are Koreans who believe that, you know, Samsung should not have a founding family. But in moments of crisis, economic downturn, or uncertainty, the Korean public largely supports these pardons because they see the families as the biggest savior with the best track record. That's what they know. That's what they've experienced. And many Koreans are not willing to experiment with new corporate models that don't have families.
Jeffrey, I'm old enough to remember that when you wanted to buy the best TV, there was only one, Japan's Sony Trinitron. And in like the last 10 or 15 years, if you walk into any of these electronics box stores, the Sony brand feels dwarfed by Samsung. So if we follow the various scandals J.Y. Lee and his family have been caught up in, one has to wonder if the crimes have directly benefited Samsung.
This is the fundamental paradox of Samsung's success. It has an extremely poor corporate governance record. It suffers from a problem called the Korea discount, which means that its stock trades at a devalued rate. But yet you look at these scandals, you look at all these problems, and then, you know, remember that this is an enormously successful corporation. Samsung Electronics alone makes up about 20% of South Korean exports. That gives you an idea of how large this firm is.
Wow. I keep hearing you use the word family, and my thoughts turn to another family, the Sopranos, or, you know, the Corleones. At what point is the Samsung chaebol model actually hobbling itself?
So the problem now, South Korea's leaders are beset with this problem that, you know, the model has worked. South Korea, which was once a dictatorship, has, you know, transitioned in the last 30 years to democracy. But this chaebol system is the leftover system from those old, you know, authoritarian years. It was designed for a past time. So Samsung and the chaebol have failed at software for the most part. They're very much a hardware maker, a semiconductor maker. So the question is, can they continue this success, or are they going to run out of steam eventually?
Jeffrey Kane is a foreign correspondent and author. He wrote Samsung Rising, a book all about the company's extraordinary success and power. Absolutely fascinating stuff, Jeffrey. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Drone warfare is not new. Right after the September 11th attacks, the U.S. began flying remotely piloted aircraft over places like Yemen and Afghanistan, UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. They were launched to track and kill members of Al-Qaeda. Today, inexpensive camera drones, the same kind that consumers can buy online, are being flown above the battlefields in Ukraine. Samuel Bendett knows the technology and how Russia and Ukraine are using it. He's an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security in Washington. So, Sam, these consumer quality drones, those hovering quadcopters with cameras, I mean, you can buy them in box stores. I've even seen them in a drugstore. They're being used in Ukraine. Who exactly is flying them?
The drones are flown by volunteers and professional military on both sides of the conflict. So they're flown by the Ukrainian volunteers, they're flown by the Ukrainian forces. They're also flown by the Russian military, as well as the Russian allied militaries from Donetsk and Lugansk. as well as by volunteers who can go through quick training on how to operate these drones and then deploy in combat.
Yeah, and so what kinds of missions specifically? Is it surveillance? Is it combat? Is it kind of much of everything?
It's a little bit of both. So most of these drones are small and light, as you have mentioned. They're commercial, and they were not designed for war. And so most of these commercial quadcopters are used for what is called ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Basically, they are flying to gather information on the adversary, on the troop movements, on the position of forces, just a few kilometers out to look over the hill, over the forest, kind of what is in their immediate vicinity. But because of this war and the way it has developed, a lot of these drones are also now being converted to combat roles. And so all sides have learned very quickly how to attach munitions and grenades to these drones and drop them with great accuracy right on top of their targets.
I was going to ask you if they're homemade rigged in any way, not intended by the manufacturer. I mean, how hard is it to drop a grenade remotely on a drone that was designed to, say, take pictures?
Oh, no, they're definitely rigged for that. Over the past decade, there's been a lot of experience by all belligerents, by both state and non-state actors, international organizations, criminal organizations, and the like, on how to convert these drones for their specific missions. And so one of the biggest missions is converting a light quadcopter to drop a grenade and drone. And the manuals are, I guess, public at this point. We could see how people do that on YouTube, on Telegram, on Twitter. These drones are difficult to sight. They are difficult to see. They're difficult to hear. And so that is probably one of their biggest advantages, in that they can literally sneak up on top of the target, and it would be way too late for the target to act.
So there are reports that soldiers on the battlefield are now feeling vulnerable to drones hovering overhead. They can't tell. Neither side can tell whether they're armed and who's launching them. What is the battlefield defense against drones?
There are electronic warfare systems which can track and jam the communication between the drone operator and the drone itself. They can kind of suppress the drone signals so it has to crash or land. There are also counter UAS systems, from small handheld rifles to very large tracked and wheeled systems that can supposedly destroy any UAV from small to very large. So both sides have these electronic warfare and counter UAS systems, but their coverage isn't absolute and it's not complete. And so there are gaps that either side is exploiting, and there are obviously significant gaps in the Russian defenses that Ukrainian UAV operators can exploit.
Can a drone operator be tracked down and targeted using geolocators in real time?
Absolutely. And this is one of the problems for using these commercial drones. They were not designed to have their communication and other sort of electronic networks proofed against any type of adversary probing or any type of adversary identification. They're simple commercial drones, and it is relatively simple to geolocate the operator who is flying these commercial drones, which is why both sides are now basically developing new types of concepts and tactics on how to use these drones.
There's news, Sam, that Russia has set up a drone piloting school in the Russian-held Ukrainian region of Donetsk, and that it's training civilians there to pilot drones. Is there concern that drones are helping to blur the lines between civilian and military roles in the war?
Well, absolutely. And the same schools are also set up in Ukraine as well. In fact, Ukraine was probably first in setting up this type of training for multiple volunteers. So this, in fact, does blur some of these lines between civilians and the military. We also have to acknowledge that the people who are doing that are volunteers. So they voluntarily put themselves at risk in order to help their respective militaries.
From what you know about the Ukraine war, how significant have drones been in successes on either side?
I think it's been fairly significant. I mean, using these commercial drones by the many thousands probably on both sides of the conflict, it is contributing to better informational situational awareness. It is contributing to better and more precise strikes, to the point where one of the retired Russian generals, General Baluyevsky, actually indicated that the commercial quadcopter is now a symbol of modern warfare and is absolutely an essential part in conducting combat operations.
Samuel Bendett is an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, speaking with us about the increasing use of drones in the Ukraine war. Thank you very much for your insight, Sam. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Every August, towns and cities across Spain celebrate their local traditions with fairs, folk culture, and live music. Some of these festivals have become so popular and attract so many visitors that locals wonder if it's still their party. Alan Ruiz Terol reports from one neighborhood in Barcelona where huge crowds are flocking to admire the decorated streets.
The neighborhood of Gracia takes pride in being like a little village within Barcelona. And just like every other village, it has its own local festivities. There are fire shows, drum bands, bumper cars, but the crown jewel is the contest for the best decorated street. This year, 23 streets are competing, each one with unique decorations, often employing recycled materials, all handmade by residents. Ferran Rovira is one of them.
The street is called Puig Martí, and the theme of this year is El Día de los Muertos of Mexico.
There are skeletons hanging from the walls, and an altar with photos of Frida Kahlo and other Mexican artists. Other streets have picked themes like the Red Riding Hood, a Viking village, Don Quixote, or a movie studio. Neighbors work for months to finish the decorations in time for the festival.
We were like a bit late with the decoration, but a lot of people came to help us, and finally we achieved what we wanted to do. And you can see in the people that takes pictures, selfies and videos of everything, so it makes you proud.
According to local authorities, the Gracia Festival welcomes more than 2 million visitors. In 2020, it was cancelled due to the pandemic, and last year it was held amid restrictions. Now, the festival is back in full swing, and with it, the huge crowds.
Yeah, most of the streets are very crowded, so I avoided them, like unless I can just go through them without any queue.
Jenny Fang from China is visiting Barcelona for the first time and has come across the festival almost by chance.
I totally didn't know there was a celebration in this area. I was just walking around this area because it's recommended by a friend that is like more local.
Some locals visit Gracia in the morning or early in the afternoon when they know the neighborhood will be less crowded. Anouk De Witt, a Barcelona local originally from the Netherlands, is visiting for the first time with her son.
Antes de ser mamá sí que venía yo aquí con la pandilla y tal, pero ya notaba yo.
Before being a mother, she would often come to the festival with her friends, she says, but it would get too crowded.
Yo soy de fuera, pero llevo viviendo aquí 30 años y he visto el boom.
She says she's a foreigner, but has been living here for 30 years and doesn't like how the city has been transformed by the tourism boom. Later in the evening, longer queues begin to form at the entrance of each street. Catalina Florici is standing in one of them.
Yeah, I don't know if it's worth it, but we're having a conversation with our friends, so that still makes it nice.
She is visiting Ivan Aguilar, who is originally from Mexico and lives in Gracia.
This represents a bit Gracia because it's organized by the neighbors. It has a community sense. You can see them while they are building things. So if you live in the neighborhood, you see them while they are working on it.
After 10 minutes, they get to enjoy the decorations of Progress Street, inspired by an amusement park. There's a roller coaster and a Ferris wheel and all kinds of attractions. But Dani Vázquez, the neighbor, says the theme has a not-so-hidden meaning.
Precisament som un parc temàtic. Som un parc temàtic una mica per fer la crítica del que s'està convertint.
He says it's a veiled criticism of the festival and the neighborhood as a whole, which he says are becoming theme parks. Because of the gentrification, he says that many people his age can no longer afford to live in Gracia once they have children and have to move to other parts of the city or to other towns. Vázquez is sitting in the middle of the street with visitors passing by as we speak. At times, he says, it feels like being in a safari with visitors taking pictures of neighbors eating lunch. Having the best street decorations poses an uneasy dilemma, he says, since more people will come to visit it. Speaking in this very interview, too, he says, can lead to more people visiting the street, but at the same time he wants to give his opinion. Contradictions are inevitable. In the end, Progress Street took the third place in this year's contest, recorded in this video by one of the people there. The prize? Free tickets for an actual amusement park. For The World, I'm Alan Ruterol in Barcelona.
If you live in a bilingual country, you get used to hearing things like this.
Merci, mes amis. Thank you. Thank you, my friends.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, you heard what he did there, switching between French and English? In so doing, he connects with more than 90% of his constituents who speak one of those languages at home. But according to new census data out this week, Canada's linguistic diversity is on the rise. The world's Bianca Hillier has more.
The new census data comes from Statistics Canada, the country's national statistics office. Eric Caron-Mélenfant is the assistant director of the Center for Demographics there. He says one highlight from this week's release is
1 in 8 Canadian, or 4.6 million, now speak a language at home that is not English nor French.
That's up 16% from just 5 years ago. What's more, a quarter of Canadians, about 9 million people, now have a first official language other than English or French. It's all part of a trend demographers have been watching for the past few decades.
Canada's linguistic diversity is really increasing.
Jean-Pierre Corbet teaches sociology at Laval University in Quebec City. He says these shifts in languages are mostly due to immigration.
We are seeing a very, very strong increase in the proportion of immigrants who are from Asia.
Since 2016, the number of Malayalam speakers rose 129%. Hindi speakers grew by 66%, and Punjabi speakers increased by 49%, surpassing 500,000 across Canada. That doesn't surprise Gurinder Mann, a lecturer on Punjabi language and culture at the University of British Columbia. He says he noticed the change just by walking around.
There's a lot of signage now in various places that are in Punjabi. So that by itself is certainly a very notable indication that there's certainly a very growing number of individuals that speak Punjabi within the city.
Mann says over the past couple of years, more students have also been signing up for his Punjabi language course. And on the streets,
predominantly, you will certainly hear English a lot more, but in Surrey or other maybe areas throughout Metro Vancouver, if you close your eyes and you open your ears, then you can certainly get the sense that Punjabi is clearly a spoken language.
Over in Quebec, you'll hear a lot more French on the streets. Most of Canada's French-speaking population lives there. Eric Caron-Mélenfant from Statistics Canada says the census shows that countrywide,
in Canada, the proportion of the population who speak French at home is diminishing.
People mostly speaking French at home dropped nearly 1% from the total population since the last census. That's led to some concern over French being at risk. But Caron-Mélenfant says there's no need to worry.
What we see is that the number of people who know French is increasing.
The number of French speakers has grown by more than 100,000 people. It's just not growing as quickly as other languages are, so the proportion is down. Later this year, Statistics Canada will publish another census report. It will look at which languages are spoken in the workplace. Analysts say this will create an even more clear picture of the shifting language dynamics in Canada. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This summer, we've been taking you around the globe to hear the songs that are on heavy rotation, from Spain to Norway and India. Allah, Allah, ya baba, wa salam alayki, ya baba. Allah, Allah. Today, we're off to East Asia to hear the latest hit from the Taiwanese king of mandopop. From Shanghai, the world's Rebecca Canther is our DJ.
No beaches or convertibles. The song of the summer in the Chinese-speaking world has magic and time travel instead. Sounds like an unlikely recipe for a hit song, but the artist, Zhou Jielun, or as he's known in English, Jay Chou, is a mandopop megastar. He's been mixing R&B, rap, and classical for over 20 years and has a huge fan base here. This is his first album out in 6 years. So about the song, it's called 最伟大的作品, the greatest works of art. In the music video, Jay Chou travels to Paris, finds an antique piano, and travels back in time to pay his respects to great artists throughout history. He performs magic tricks for Monet, Magritte, Salvador Dali, and the Chinese artist Sun Yu, and inspires their masterpieces. And if that's not enough, the song also features a cameo by Chinese classical pianist Lang Lang, and the two face off in a piano battle. Mm-hmm. Lillian Zhang has been listening to the song. She says Jay Chou's music has accompanied her throughout her life.
When I was in middle school, he's just come out and become a singer. And his songs are so unique and so edgy at that time. But everyone loves it. Everyone crazy about it. From middle school to college, I listened to his song.
Zhang says she's pregnant. And her husband plays Jay Chou's music for her and their unborn child every day, including the song Greatest Works of Art. She says the song has been so popular this summer because fans were hungry for new music from Jay Chou, who doesn't put out songs as often as he used to.
So when the songs came out, everyone was so excited. Everyone must you have to listen to it. It's just like that.
Han Jia is also a longtime fan of Jay Chou, although she admits the track isn't in her top 10 list of his songs. She prefers his earlier work. But she says it doesn't matter. Any song he puts out is going to be a hit.
就是他已经不是一个歌手,他是一个icon。在过去几年里面,
he's no longer a singer, she says. He's an icon. The music video has gotten 167 million views on Chinese social media. Hong Kong DJ Ocean Chun says the song has been on heavy rotation on RTHK radio since it was released last month. She says the music video has been popular, but the song has its critics.
The lyric, the people saying meaningless. It's discounting some of the greatest artists, just a breakdown list. The people asking, keep on asking, what did he want to say?
She says online, opinions have been divided.
The comments are very extreme. The bad comments is mostly thinking about this song. It sounds the same of 20 years ago. Positive side is they are thinking Jay Chou still hanging there and doing the same thing of Jay Chou.
So basically, the haters hate what the lovers love. Jay Chou is still Jay Chou. And this song is unmistakably his. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
On our Twitter, we've got a link for you to a Spotify playlist with our global songs of summer. We are at The World. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, enjoy the weekend.